Trainer Talks and Tales acknowledges the traditional owners and custodians of the land in which we're recording this podcast, the Turrbal and Yugara people of Meanjin. We pay our respects to elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
Trainer Talks and Tales love having an array of guests with a variety of opinions. However, the views of the individuals do not necessarily reflect the perspectives of the host facilities.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talks and Tales, your insights into zoos and aquariums. We hope you've all been having a great fortnight and haven't missed us too much. You're joined, of course, by Tess and Daisy. Now, Daisy, last week you were pretty excited to tell us about what you've been up to, and you're at Phillip Island. So how have you been? What have you got to share with us this week?
Yes. Hi, everyone. Hi, Tess. I am so excited to talk about this week, actually, because it was honestly one of the best weeks that I've had this year, and really great for personal development and a lot for work development. So many new learnings and so many new insights into different ways that we can maybe do things, different things that I've been able to bring back to better our colony of penguins and seals as well. So we are very lucky. Sea Life is owned by Merlin, and amongst the Sea Life teams, we have something called a Sea Life Trust. So Sea Life Trust pretty much funds a lot of conservation projects across the globe, but we also have a little bit of funding to be able to do sort of some staff stuff alongside conservation. So basically anything that's relevant to what we do as keepers, we can put together a bit of a proposal and see if it will get approved, if it's relevant, and get the funding approved. So last year, one of the girls from work, she put together a great proposal, and she headed down to Kangaroo Island and helped out with the Australian sea lion tracking that they do down there. And I thought it'd be fantastic to look at our only species of penguins that's native to our country and be able to be a part of such an incredible research program that they do down in Phillip Island. And thankfully it was approved. So really cool to be able to kind of do that through work as well. And I definitely recommend if anyone listening has the ability to do some sort of conservation thing through work, or, you know, even obviously outside of work, I would highly recommend, because it is such a great exposure and like really good understanding for kind of different roles in the industry and also working with wild animals too. So yeah, pretty much spent the week down with the penguin team. So the penguin parade and penguin team are all run through Phillip Island Nature Parks. They also look after, I can't remember the name of the island now, but it was really, really cool and full of cows, so I really liked it. But they have a really fantastic bandicoot program, and they are working towards bush tongue curlew rehabilitation as well, which is really fun. But obviously their primary focus is the penguins. Phillip Island used to be home to 10 different colonies, but now they actually only have one main colony on the island. So that all came down to predators, a lot of foxes that are obviously on the island. And thankfully they were able to eradicate foxes, and they've been fox free since 2017, which is fantastic. And since then, they've continued to see those populations thrive amongst that one colony. They're yet to see other colonies start to reappear, but you know, it's definitely something that they are hopeful that they might get to see in the future. So pretty much our days were going out into the field. So it was honestly one of the most beautiful locations, literally on the side of a cliff, open ocean. It was incredible. We were amongst so many different burrows. So they do utilize artificial burrows as well as natural burrows, but majority of the stuff we were looking into was the natural burrows, which are so teeny tiny and like home to all these little penguins. And pretty much we are taking penguins out, weighing some of the penguins, microchipping them if they're not already chipped. If we come across chicks, then as long as they're over a certain gram weight, so I think it's about 700 grams, we can microchip the chicks, and we would measure their beak length, their beak depth, and their total head length as well. Good indication for gender going forward, and also just great to get that information on the penguins as well. Also had the option to take some blood from some of the penguins towards the end, which was really interesting. The blood that they're taking is actually used to completely analyze the diet and what they're feeding on. So they've been able to utilize that to affect sort of fisheries and the fish in the area as well. One thing I was telling you, Tess, about that I thought was really interesting is that amongst the colonies where they have the most common paths, they've actually put in three different way bridges. So when the penguins come out of the water at nighttime, they go through this way bridge, which takes their weight and scans their microchip. They've been able to work out roughly how much a penguin poo weighs and how much a chick penguin poo weighs. And in the morning, when the penguin returns to sea, it takes the same weight again. And they've been able to work out the difference in the weight. And that works out exactly how much they're feeding their chicks. And then with that data, they've been able to take that to the fisheries and say, this is actually how much fish these penguins need to sustain their chicks' lives, and have been able to make changes due to that to the amount of fishing that's happening within that area, which I think is fantastic. And it's so cool to hear about those successful programs that are happening around the country, and especially with like such an amazing native species like a little blue penguin.
Yeah, you were telling us this the other day, and I was like, you have to tell us this on the podcast. This is fascinating. Like the fact that this is being put into place and affecting the fisheries and the laws in that area, like that's really cool. That's amazing research. And similar concept to what you've spoken about before, just a little bridge, or like similar to a podoscope, just a little way station. So pretty simple, but very effective. Hey.
Yeah, absolutely. And they've had, sometimes they've gone down there and they've seen like snakes coming through on the cameras and stuff. So they've had like such a variety of different species down there, which I think is really fun. I was also really lucky because I happened to be down there at the same time as one of the seal researchers. So there is a big population, about 18,000 breeding Australian fur seals, about a kilometre off the coastline of Phillip Island. I squinted really hard from the coast, but you can't quite see them, unfortunately. They do daily trips out there to see them, but I just didn't have the time. And she was telling me all about the research that they're doing. They have found these seals come across a lot of entanglement. Recently, they've been able to go out there, actually put some seals under anesthetic on the rocks, which I can only imagine is an intense procedure, considering I know how much goes into doing it within a zoo and aquarium. And being able to remove all of that entanglement, pop trackers onto those seals. And from being able to do that, they've been able to see with all of them that roughly about 2 weeks after that happens, they're actually doing a lot of swimming. So they're seeing them still thriving, because I think the question was around whether these animals are able to still thrive after being entangled and also having interference with humans. But it's been fantastic for them to see that it's actually been really successful, and that hopefully they can take that back to the people who are funding these projects and say, hey, this is actually working and it's absolutely worth our time. So that was really interesting. You know, look, there's definitely some eye openers, some, you know, the reality of the wild is not nice. Like it's not all these hopes and dreams and beautiful things. There's predators, there is, you know, starvation that happens all the time, entanglements, etc. It was, yeah, definitely pretty raw and eye-opening. And I'm not 100% sure that it's something that I could do long term. You know, I feel like I'm a very emotional person, very empathetic person. And yeah, I think it would be pretty hard to see that day in and day out. And the team were very aware of that. There's a lot of talk around mental health, which I think was really good and something I didn't overly expect. So that was great. One thing, you know, and I'm going to touch really briefly on this because I am not an expert in the slightest, but I definitely felt that there was a little bit of a gap between zoos and aquariums and kind of the wild, and that gap in between, that maybe some of these animals that aren't able to be released could be placed into care. And is there even somebody there advocating for these animals to be moved into that area? And I know what happens with, you know, natural nature is that, you know, if animals come across trouble, unfortunately a lot of them die in the wild. That's just how it is. But there was definitely a few circumstances where I think human influenced issues could have been addressed slightly differently. But you know, you're tackling a government body of how many people with so much more experience, and I'm just this little baby person coming in saying, hey, like, what about this? So like, I would absolutely love to learn more about that, where those decisions are made, you know, who is vouching for a second chance of life in a facility, how are we monitoring the backup populations in human care. I don't know. I don't have the answers, but it was definitely something that I would love to learn a little bit more about for sure. But yeah, overall, like, I got to spend the day at the rehab hospital, which was great. Fed some, like, helped feed some little penguins, build up some strength for them to get released, some shearwaters, seabirds. Like, it was great. Like, the island itself is just so beautiful. So many echidnas, kangaroos, not kangaroos, sorry, wallabies, lots of different birds. Yeah, it was fantastic. Like, if you've never been to Phillip Island, I definitely recommend. And yeah, the whole thing, I'm very grateful that I had the opportunity to do, because I've definitely learned a lot and come back to my manager and been like, we need to change all of this because this is really fun. And she's like, oh, Daisy, let's calm down. But that's what it's for, hey. Like, it's to open your eyes and, give you an idea of a few other things that we could possibly be doing to enhance the welfare of the animals in our care.
Absolutely. And like you said, it's professional development, but it's good for you to see what's happening out there in the wild because sometimes we can get caught up in what we're doing in our facilities when there is maybe a bigger picture out there too. So sounds like you had a great time.
Yes, yeah, no, it was fantastic. But how have you been, Tess? What have you been up to this week? Anything to recommend?
Yeah, I've been really well, thank you. I actually did have a recommendation. It's touching on what I recommended last week. So I recommended, or last fortnight, I should say, a book by Darryl Jones, and I was hooked. So I read another one from him, and it's called Feeding the Birds at Your Table. So I imagine as I say that text, 90% of you went, oh, but we shouldn't feed birds. And that is the general consensus here in Australia. And that's what I thought people would believe, and honestly, he did too. But the thing is, a lot of people actually do it, and it's so frowned upon, they just do it surreptitiously. And I found that really interesting. So, in other countries, there's a lot of information for feeding birds, and it's not so much frowned upon. But here in Australia, it's just a big no-no. So, even if you Google what to feed birds, you're not given information on how to do it effectively. It's just don't do it. It's just advised, like, don't feed birds, blah, blah, blah. So, as I said, it just means that people are still doing it, but they're not telling anyone and they're not necessarily doing it correctly because they don't have any information. So, he was using this book as a way of saying, we know you're going to do it, and maybe let's address some of the issues and maybe we can actually give people the right information. So, I found it really, really interesting. And he basically spoke about what people can do to do it effectively and gave them information on how to do it responsibly as well. So rather than putting out bread, rather than putting out copious amounts of leftovers from your kitchen, maybe just think about putting out a handful of seed or just lots of information really on hygiene that people might not even consider. So it was really interesting. And for me, a big thing was people who feed birds, they're not trying to do it to be irresponsible. It's because they are seeking connection with these birds and because they love them. So it addressed that they want this connection to nature, and they often feel like there's so much damage done by humans and it's their way of giving back. And they're not inherently bad people. They're doing it for the right reasons. They love the birds. So he basically talked about he did research surveys all around Australia and was astounded to find that like 30 to 50% of households in Australia are feeding birds. Like that's how many people are feeding birds in the
What?
backyard secretly. And they're just not talking about it because it is so taboo. So I thought that was really cool. And he just listed ideas of the really common species like magpies. We all give them, or people give them minced meat, but that causes metabolic bone diseases. It's really not good for growing chicks. So he suggested like dog meat brown brands and cover that meat with calcium powder or insectivore mix. And he's saying don't feed ducks at the park because it can give them angel wing. And if you have got bird feeders, you should clean it, sweep it, dry it every day, because if you can't guarantee this hygiene process, just don't do it. So I took a lot from it, and I like that it addressed that it is being done. So why wouldn't we give the information that people are seeking because they want to do right by the birds that they're feeding? They're not trying to do the wrong thing. So I thought I'd read out a few of the little tips that he's got. Number one, Daryl's golden rules for bird feeding: cleanliness, sweep up any leftovers and spray the area, dry in place new feed and do this daily. Provide a nutritious snack. So when we're feeding birds, it's not a meal. It should be like a handful and once a day. And that little bit goes a long way because this isn't their diet. This is just something for them to snack on, really. Never feed birds away from your home. So don't go past your front gate. This is not feeding ducks and swans at a park. It's just in your own home. And the fourth one was enjoy it, because really you're feeding the birds for yourself. and not for their benefit. So that was good to keep in mind. So I don't know. I really love that book and I really recommended it. So that's called Feeding the Birds at Your Table by Darryl Jones. Anyway, Daisy and I have been rambling for a long time. So
No, I
we'll
think
introduce
that was such a good
our speaker.
recommendation. And like exactly like you said, like there's nothing better than opening your back door and there being thousands of birds in your back garden. Like it's beautiful, but yeah, that definitely becomes the limit between, you know, the two of wanting to make sure that we're doing the right thing for the animal at the end of the day. So like I love that he's done that. I think it's probably something that was needed in the world. So yeah, hopefully people will take a lot from that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I loved it. Anyway, do you want to tell us a little bit about our guest today?
Yes, absolutely. So we are lucky enough to be joined by the lovely Kelly. So Kelly and I actually worked at Australia Zoo together for a little while, but she has developed her career and is now a vet nurse. So she's actually working for a different sea life. So we work now under the same company, but she works down in Sydney for Sea Life Sydney and Wildlife Zoo Sydney as well. So she's looking after a huge array of animals. And it was really great to chat to her all about the different species she looks after, transitioning from a keeper role to a vet nurse role, and what sort of that vet nurse role really looks like. So we took a lot out of it and we really hope that you guys do too. Kelly, welcome to Trainer Talks and Tales. We are both really excited to chat to you today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I am a little bit nervous, but otherwise I'm really excited to be here.
Oh, nothing to be nervous about, I promise you. But I'm so excited to chat a little bit more about vet nursing because it's a topic that we haven't actually discussed yet on the podcast. And I guess a little bit of a brief history. Kelly and I, we used to work together at Australia Zoo briefly, like a long time ago. You were head of exotics, I think, at the time, and I was just a baby and you taught me how to walk a wombat. So I remember that pretty well.
Not a baby.
I was very new
so
into the
extravaganza.
Well, we'd love to kind of start off a little bit about that, sort of touching a little bit more on your career and how that's kind of progressed to where you are and what you're doing now.
Yeah, sure. So I've been a zookeeper or within the zoo industry since 2006. So kind of showing my age, but I've been around for a little while now. I've been lucky enough to work at a few different zoos. I started my career as a baby volunteer at the Reptile Park in Gosford. Worked there for 8 years and loved it, but then moved up to Queensland and was lucky enough to work at Australia Zoo for a while with everything from wombats to dingoes to binturongs to otters and everything in between, which was great. Spent a few years there and then moved back home to family and got another job at Hunter Valley Zoo, which is a beautiful little zoo in the wine country. So amazing scenery as well, amazing, beautiful area, but really, really tiny little zoo. So it was very interesting going from such a big place like Australia Zoo back down to a really small facility. While I was there, I did my vet nursing certificate and I finished it. And as Daisy knows, it's not, it's often who you know within this industry, but I got a call from a friend saying that there was a vacancy at Wildlife Sydney Zoo for a vet nurse. And I said, well, if you'll have me, then I would love to join the team. So, and I've been there ever since.
That's so cool. And I love that you said about going from a bigger facility to a smaller facility, because I kind of went the other way around, went from working with, you know, maybe four people in the keeping department to Australia Zoo, which is crazy. Did you struggle or like notice any or prefer working in a smaller environment to how big the zoo is?
Yeah, I think at heart I much prefer working in a small family like situation. Like my current facility is not family owned, but it is definitely a little bit smaller. I like the collaboration between everyone. Like I like working with the maintenance team and you know, the front of house team as well. I mean, at Hunter Valley Zoo there was, you know, one person from each department, but I still really like working with everyone. I felt like the bigger zoo you get, you often don't talk to the people around the zoo. And Daisy will know that there were so many people at Australia Zoo that you wouldn't even know half the keeping team. And that's just not me. I like being much more familiar with the people I work with and really creating that team environment.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I much prefer working in a smaller facility. I feel like you just get to know everyone better, know who is great at what. You know, people just take their roles and you end up forming so much more of a family environment, which is so important.
Yeah, you lean on each other so much that like the days are can be long and tiring sometimes. So I feel like if you know like you have that supportive environment, that's really important in this industry.
Absolutely. Now, do you mind telling us a little bit more about your current role and what species you're actually looking after now?
Yeah, so I now work at Wildlife Sydney Zoo and Sea Life Sydney Aquarium. They're based in Darling Harbour. They're right next door to each other, separate attractions, but we have the same support team of staff around it. I am the health supervisor now, so I have a team around me. I have got two vet nurses and two rehab staff. So as a team, we look after everything that's pulled off display that might need some medical treatment, or some time, rest and recover. Or we also look after any of the quarantine animals. So all the new arrivals to the zoo or aquarium, we look after them in quarantine for a couple of weeks, make sure they tick all their boxes and get that fit for display. And then we also have a rehab portion. So we look after any rescue sea turtles and sea snakes. So we have quite a variety that we look after each day, which definitely keeps me on my toes.
Wow, that's such an array of species to be taken care of. And yeah, sea snakes and sea turtles. That's amazing.
Yeah,
Yes,
they
so
are
cool.
really cool.
And I love,
Yeah, we've
like, I've
had
never
few.
heard of like a health team before. Like, that's a really like a new kind of, I guess, team that I've not come across before. So that's really interesting that you have that set up down there and like who kind of forms as part of that team. Like that, yeah, I find that really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, Wildlife Sydney's had a vet nurse for many years, way before my time. So that's not too new. But we used to have off display areas with, quarantine or recovering animals, and they were just kind of looked after by the team that they belonged to. So if an animal needed some time off display and some rest, that would be looked after by the staff that would have looked after them on display. And we just found that the areas themselves needed some more ownership over them and some pride in the work and look after the space a little bit more. So we created a team that's dedicated to looking after those animals while they need that care. But that does mean that those team members can look after everything from well, at the moment they've got a brown cuckoo dove, an octopus, a bunch of tropical fish, some lizards, they've got the sea turtle, sea snake. A couple of little sharks. Yeah, I think that's
That's
it.
insane. And have you found since having that sort of department that it has correlated with an improved welfare for those animals?
I think so. I think that that team can work really closely with the two vet nurses as well, so they can make sure that those animals are getting everything that they need. They work closer with the vets and all the treatments and things like that. And as I said, I think it just creates ownership of the space and just gives them a bit of pride in to look after the area. And I really think that it's working really well for us.
Yeah, that's so cool. And I know we kind of touched a little bit on transitioning from a big facility to a small facility, but I would love to talk a little bit about how you found the transition from being a keeper for so long to moving into vet nursing and how that sort of looked for you.
Yeah, my husband's army, so I do tend to move around a little bit. And to be honest, I thought that the vet nursing might just give me a few other options in case I wasn't always lucky enough to land a zoo job wherever I went. But my inspiration was while I was at Australia Zoo. The vet team there are like just incredible. And I was really inspired by the zoo vet nurse at the time. Big shout out to her, Tara. She like could she knew everything about every animal across the whole entire zoo, and I just really loved how watching her work with the vets as well. I thought it was an amazing partnership. So when I moved on from Australia Zoo, I thought, no, I'll definitely get my vet nursing. Never in my wildest dreams thought that I would go back into zoos straight away. But I love that I have.
Yeah, we couldn't keep you away.
No.
Now, we'd love to know a little bit more about what a day looks like for you. Can you tell us, for example, maybe what is the most common procedure that you do?
Yeah, the team will laugh at me, but probably the most common procedure that we run are preventative health and like fecals. So, we do a whole array of preventative health, like skin scrapes and body scores and weights and things like that. But fecals is a big one as well. We don't routinely worm our animals. We tend to test and then treat as required. So that requires a lot of testing. So we do that quite a lot for all the animals across the zoo and the aquarium. But yeah, I'm a big fan of preventative health rather than reactive health, and trying to get routine animal health checks, particularly for the elderly animals. So we try and book in routine anaesthetics rather than reactive procedures, get the animals down, get them under GA, do some x-rays, get some bloods, check their teeth, all those things before an issue has been flagged. And we can just create a bit of a baseline that way. We know what's normal for that animal as they're entering their twilight years. Yeah, so that's one of the things I'm really passionate about. One thing that I tried really hard to install when I started at Wildlife, and we're still doing to this day.
So basically, you said you do a lot of fecals. I'm picturing all the keepers just radioing you and telling you they've got little presents for you in the fridge. And
100%. Yeah. I literally sent an email out on Friday and said, Div 1, it's your turn. And then by Saturday, I think we had like 30 or 40 samples dropped on my fridge. And the team was so excited that they'd done what we asked of them. But it did take a few hours.
No, I think it's important to make sure people know it's not all glamorous.
Exactly. It's not all dugongs.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. 100%. I'm sure throughout your career, you've had some pretty incredible moments, like specializing, I guess, primarily with the vet nursing. What has been sort of a standout moment for you?
Yeah, there's been a bunch of different procedures that would come to mind. I think probably one of the craziest ones was trying to organize a CT scan for a 120 kilo sea turtle. She didn't fit in the typical cat and dog CT equipment that you find at most vets, or at least a few vets in the Sydney region. And we've definitely taken other animals for CTs before, but she was too big for their equipment. So we had to track down the racehorses and find where they take their animals for CTs, and actually take her to a horse CT a little bit west.
Oh, so. Wow.
Yeah, so that was fun.
Wow, I never even, never really thought about what they do if they don't fit in. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Horses are a lot bigger than dogs and cats, so that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and luckily there's a few racehorse vets out Western Sydney and a few areas like that. So there was one out there that I was able to track down, and they were pretty excited to have a sea turtle, to be honest.
Yeah. I think they would have thought they were getting stitched up when you had that phone call.
Yeah. You mentioned really, really quickly earlier about working with the dugong. I was just wondering, because pig is one of the coolest animals I've ever met, do you do much sort of preventative healthcare with pig, or what sort of things do you do to maintain his health and welfare?
Yeah, 100%. He is incredibly special. He's also incredibly smart. When I first started, we were injecting him with like an iron supplement, Hemoplex, so like a vitamin supplement as well. And he would recognize the vet that gave him that needle. And every time the vet turned up to his space, he would swim to the other end. Just the mere sight of the vet would cause him to remember that needle. We very quickly found an oral paste that does the same thing, transitioned him to that, so no more needles. And then a big part of the preventive health is getting him to not be so responsive to the vet's presence. So we take the vet down, we do routine sessions with pig where we go and just hang out, we take all our vet equipment down, we be as crazy and as out there as we can, and we bang stuff around and we grab things out and just hang out with him and give him some treats and some attention, and just really change that relationship around. So a massive part of the preventative health is building that relationship, and not just for this, like for the keepers or acarists to be doing that training, but also for us to come on board and be there as well, so they don't get so scared when it comes to their health check day.
Yeah, I think that's so important. That sort of like veterinary decency is so like important in all facilities to do, because you can set it up perfectly with the people they see every day and they love, but at the end of the day, they're not necessarily the people that are taking blood or doing ultrasounds or x-rays, etc. So yeah, it's definitely so important.
Yeah, we're doing some really cool stuff with him. He swims voluntarily into a sling, so that we can get a weight. We're working on asking him to hold his breath and roll onto his back to show his tummy, so we can see his belly and feel that, and potentially do some ultrasounds. The girls are working on a tail present if we needed to do any injections that way, or flipper present if we needed to do any blood draws. So yeah, we're doing some really amazing things with him. He's incredibly smart, so I have no doubt that he could do it all.
That's a whole lot of lettuce you're using for all of that.
Bean sprouts.
Oh, bean
Bean sprouts
sprouts.
is training reward.
Yum.
Yeah,
Yum.
I know. He loves the lettuce too. He gets the lettuce for like the bonding sessions. So if we're just hanging out with him and just giving him his vitamins and stuff, we'll just give him the lettuce. But yeah, otherwise he'll work for bean sprouts.
Now, you recently attended a conference for zoo and wildlife nursing. Can you share a little bit more about that conference?
Yeah, so it's a relatively new conference. I believe that this year's one was like the second formal one that they've run. It's run by a branch of ASZK, or Australian Zookeeping Society, that's aimed at zoo and wildlife vet nurses. So do have to be a vet nurse to be part of that subcommittee. But they ran a conference where we all got together down in Melbourne, and just shared presentations on different nursing wins and tips and tricks that other people had done within the industry.
Yeah,
That's
that's so
awesome. We love
cool.
a conference.
Oh,
Yeah.
love a conference. Yeah, I
Yeah, my
think it's
boss
really.
teases me that I love a conference too.
Oh yeah, I think Tess and I like would be very drunk if we had a shot for every single time we said conference in our podcast. We love a conference, but they're so valuable, right? Like, think how much you learn every single time you go, and it's such and like aside from all the learnings, like you just get to meet a bunch of really cool people that like love what you love, and that's so fun.
Yeah, I like honestly the presentations were amazing. I could sit there and listen to people all day, but you know, I'm not really going to do a giraffe anesthetic anytime soon. I just work with Australian natives, so maybe not that relevant to me. But honestly, meeting the other people is what I love, like just meeting other zoo vet nurses, so other people that work within industry as a vet nurse and trying to figure it out. Just having those contacts and people to call on is really special.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of my favorite things about what we do. With that though, did you have like a particular presentation that you felt was really inspirational or a slight moment that you took a lot from?
Yeah, there was quite a few really good ones this year. One that was probably a little bit more resonated with me about preventative health and all that sort of veterinary conditioning and getting the animals exposed to veterinary care and allowing animals choice in their veterinary care was one done by one of the vet nurses from Taronga. So she spoke about the annual health checks that they do on all of their different animals, but in particular the chimp group. So asking 21 chimps to sit and take a voluntary sedation, so that they could calmly be sedated and then head over to the vet block for their health check.
21.
21.
Oh my gosh, wow.
And they did it. So that is just incredible because that involves other chimps watching chimps get injected and fall asleep
Yeah.
and be carried away and then so forth. And they're such a clever and just such an amazing animal, to watch that, observe it, and then voluntarily put themselves in that position as well, just shows how much trust, how much work and dedication went into that. But no darting, no chasing, no, no stress on the animals that way. They all received their health check in an absolutely beautiful way.
Wow, we've come so far, hey. Like that actually gave me goosebumps thinking about honestly 21 other sets of eyes, or 20, I should say, looking at that one chimp, be like, okay, well, we're doing this,
We're
and yeah,
next.
creating that environment
Today's
to help.
the day.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing.
It's pretty special too, because like if you take your cat or dog for an anaesthetic, they say, you know, don't feed it water at this time, don't feed it food at this time. But obviously we've, you know, our critters, we can't always stick to those hard and fast rules. And, you know, some of those chimps were getting a little bit of Powerade before their procedure. Just, you know, a little bit of like, it's okay, everything's fine. So just working with the vet team and understanding that, you know, we may be giving them a little bit of liquid to just get asked that confirmation. Like I know our tree kangaroo, when we do his anaesthetic, he gets a watermelon juice in a syringe. So our tree kangaroo will sit there and calmly take a sedation from the vet if he can just have a little bit of watermelon juice in a syringe. And so our vet is able to work with him and go, okay, well, you know, it's not going to be hard and fast, no food, but this is the best we're going to get.
That's so good. And I guess as well, by using like that small amount of reinforcement that's still safe for the animal, you're setting yourself up for the next time that you have to do it and trying to keep it as positive as possible long term rather than just that one time.
Yeah, our tree kangaroo has to be removed from display every day for the staff safety. So he has to go in and out of his crate routinely every day. Obviously on vet day, it was a bit of a more of a procedure because he was in it for quite some time. It was a long recovery for him, but he had to go back into that crate the next morning, and he did. So it shows that he didn't have too many adverse effects.
Still reinforcing.
Yeah.
Now, we do always have a couple of questions from our listeners, so we're going to launch straight into that. Will doing vet tech increase your competitiveness for getting a job with wildlife? That was our first question.
I think it depends on what you want to do. If you are after like becoming a zookeeper or an acris, I don't believe that doing your vet nursing will give you an edge. I do believe strongly that they are separate careers. So I wouldn't do it if you were trying to get in and thought, oh, maybe the vet nursing will make me stand out. I think what will make you stand out is working more directly with wildlife, so volunteering at different organizations, seeing if you can go and spend some time at rescue groups and things like that. I think that hands-on experience is what will set you apart. However, everyone gets into this career differently, and for those that have been a vet nurse, or sorry, have been a vet nurse for a little while and then want to transition across to zookeeping, it's still animal handling. Like, it's all working with animals. So all of that is still incredibly valuable, but I don't think it would give you the edge as such. I wouldn't do it because you thought it was going to give you more. I would do it if you thought you wanted to be a vet nurse.
Yeah, I think that's a really good answer. And I like how you said to consider them as very separate careers as well. And even though you work in the same area, possibly they are, very different roles. Now, question number two, which I love, which could be answered in a few different ways, and we kind of touched on this a little bit earlier, but the question was, do you think that wildlife nursing is sustainable?
Yeah, I was a bit thrown by this question at first, but I think it can be taken a few different ways. I know in terms of sustainable, in terms of your mental health and being in the career for a long time, I went from zookeeping to vet nursing, which I thought was going to be less vigorous on my body. I thought after all these years, my knees are just not keeping up with the zookeeping world anymore. So I thought, oh, I'll try nursing. Side note, it's not easier on your body. So don't go down that path if that's what you want. But mental health wise, I do know a few nurses before me did burn out. It is a really challenging job. Not just in zoos, though. I believe like the vet nurse community as a whole and the vet community as a whole, the mental health side of things really does come into play. So it's not for everyone. I think it can have sustainability, but I think you need to keep working at it. And I think you need to have those things in your toolbox that you can take away and have some time for yourself at home, or work out how you can disconnect and really look after yourself in the meantime, because at work you're looking after all the animals and all the stuff. So you need to have a way of making sure that you look after yourself to keep going.
Absolutely. Now, the final question is, what is the rarest patient you have ever treated?
I don't know exactly. Like, I don't know the rarest animal in terms of whether it's critically endangered or vulnerable, things like that. But I have been really lucky to work on a few breed for release programs while being at Sydney, and working with endangered animals that way. We have the White Seahorse program, where we release seahorses back into Sydney Harbour. So as a vet team, I've been really lucky enough to be able to care for those and work with the staff to get those ready for release. And then the other one that's really special is our zebra sharks. We've been able to send fertilised eggs back over to Indonesia for them to hatch over there. And then once they hatch, they release them into a protected reserve and start repopulating the group, the species over there, which has been really special to be part of as well. So those bits of, they really allow you to sort of know that you're making a difference, and gives you something to keep going as well.
Yeah, that's now, so cool. So
I'm
cool.
Not sure if you noticed, but Daisy's a drongo and she forgot to do the fast five.
I know.
So we are going to
I just said
hopefully our listeners notice, because we're just going to keep on rolling, and if you notice, well done. If you didn't, then you don't pay enough attention, listeners. But let's end the episode with it, just for a bit of a laugh. So Daisy, let's wrap it up. Hit Kelly with the fast five.
Okay, question number one: favorite takeout?
Ooh, pizza.
Favorite species?
Tassie devil.
Marine or terrestrial?
Terrestrial.
Who is your favorite wombat?
Wendy.
And finally, what would you be doing if you weren't working with animals?
Probably something with kids.
Love that. That's so good. Well, yeah, apologies about that.
I love it.
I can't believe I missed that. I realized about 30 seconds after I started talking that I'd completely missed it.
It's fine. You
got to keep us on our toes. I love it. Yeah. It was really great talking to you, Kelly. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much again, Kelly. We'll chat to you soon.
Well, guys, hope you enjoyed that episode. We haven't actually spoken to a vet nurse before, so it was great to get a bit of an insight into her daily role and how she's progressed in the industry. Hope you enjoyed it, and we'll be back in your ears next fortnight. See ya.
Bye.